My name is Pearson. I'm an alcoholic. Hey. Thanks for asking me to do this. You know, it's probably in this room, I've probably heard Robert's story more than anyone else in here, but it's kind of like a good movie. Basically, I keep watching it over and over again because basically, as I forget how good it is until I hear it again. You know, Robert is my sponsor. He's my friend. You know, he showed me how to do this deal. And, you know, he shows a lot of guys how to do this deal. And since I've been working with him, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink. It's a miracle. So for that, I give you Robert Bell. All right.
Thanks, Pierce. My name's Robert Bell. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
I'll try to live up to that, and I want to thank Jerry and the Primary Purpose Group for inviting me back. It's always good to be invited back. That doesn't always happen to alcoholics. And I was sitting on the back row looking this way, thinking last time I spoke, we faced that way, and I could see the clock. So I've got my watch handy, so we'll get out on time. I've been told it's always good to get people out within an hour, so we'll see if we can do that. And I was thinking about a couple things as I came over here, but the one thing that I really thought about is when I say my name's Robert and I'm an alcoholic, that's the most important thing I can say today. I may be a spouse, I may be a father, I may be a son, I may be a brother, I may be an employee, I may employ other people. The fact that I'm an alcoholic is the most important thing. I have this special relationship with alcohol that's unique, it's different from any other beverage. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later when I get to it, but that is just the key thing. That's the thing my life really hinges on. I've been sober since April 10th, 2001, and that's when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous because that was not my first trip here. And it's probably happened to other people. I love to hear about people that get one white chip and they get sober, they stay sober, they do what they need to do, but that's not the case with me. And I say I came back, it was challenging. I got here 9 years earlier. It's 1992. I had a variety of problems. I sent to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard a lot of things. I'd heard things like meeting makers make it. And I made a lot of meetings. But I did not get sober. And I did not have a spiritual experience as a result of making meetings. I had a spiritual experience as a result of taking the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd hear things like, if you can hang out till midnight, another 2 hours, 45 minutes, you're a winner. Well, I didn't feel like a winner when I was sitting in my chair and my knuckles were white and my teeth were clenched. And I had no solution to alcoholism. And so if I'm not comfortable with Alcoholics Anonymous, I turned to the drink, and that happened to me over and over and over. And, you know, I could tell you a variety of stories, and I get down to the basic point. What is the one thing that changed so dramatically since April 10th, 2001 to this date that I had not had to take a drink? I could boil it down to one word and one word only. Sponsorship. I got a sponsor. You know, I nearly kill myself with that intellectual pride that we hear about in some of our literature by being unwilling to ask for help. But getting a sponsor was the gateway to me getting sober. And, you know, he didn't tell me what to do. He was not one of those kind of sponsors that told me what to do. He showed me what to do. And I really don't quote the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, but on page 44, it says, if when you want to, you find that you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you can't control the amount you take, then you're probably alcoholic. And if that be the case, you may be suffering from an experience which only spiritual experience will conquer. You may suffer an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And I'm thinking about an illness. How is alcoholism an illness? I mean, I just like to go out and get drunk every day, couple blackouts a week. How is that an illness? I could not buy into that whole thing. When I thought about illnesses, I thought about, you know, I get a strep throat every couple of years. I go to the doctor. They give me a handful of pills. I take it as directed. Strep throat goes away. So I come here, and I'm thinking one way to get rid of an illness is a pill. Maybe there's a spirituality pill. Give me one of them. No, give me two or three of them. I know who I am. Spirituality pill might work. Or I had an appendicitis. I check into the hospital. They cut that thing out, and I'm done. I'm through. That happened to me 20 years ago. I've not been thinking about an appendix. Don't go to meetings of people who suffer from appendicitis. I don't have to do any follow-up. That's the kind of illness I want. Who wants the kind of illness where you have to turn your will and your life over the care of God? The kind of illness where you have to make inventory. The kind of illness where you have to make amends to virtually everybody you've known because of the way you act. And then on top of that, who wants to reach out your hand to the sick and suffering man and woman that walks in that door and show them what we do to try and save their life? Not me. See, that did not sound like a good deal when I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous. Today it sounds like the best deal possible. It really, really does. So how did I end up in Alcoholics Anonymous? I was born right here in Atlanta. Grew up sort of in this neighborhood, a little bit west of here near Chestain Park. Had parents that raised me well. They taught me right from wrong. good educational opportunities, good religious training. My dad would have been the kind of guy that's described as he is honest as the day is long. And that was the kind of things they tried to teach me. And really, if you looked at me as a little kid, I seemed to be in line, doing okay. But in the background, there's stuff going on. You know, I was doing okay in school, doing so-so in sports, but I somehow felt a bit disconnected from the other kids. And I was probably facing the same anxiety, fears that adolescents and pre-adolescents have. However, for me, it felt like I just couldn't connect. And, you know, just moving on to that day that I took that first drink. It's over there near Chastain Park. It was at the high school gym. And I was sitting there with my buddy Rex. I was 15. He was 16. He had an older brother. He had drank before. But I can remember that day almost like it's yesterday when that van pulled up in front of me and the McClellan brothers pulled up. It was in a Volkswagen van. And these were guys that were like 16 and 17. They played in a band. They drove around. They took women out. They talked about taking women out. They talked about having sex with women. Well, I'd had sex. It had already been menage a uno. But when they opened that door and they said, Robert and Rex, you want to come have a couple beers with us? We looked at one another and we jumped in that van. And the thing that makes me alcoholic happened that very night. You know, I jumped in there, I'm thinking I'm going to have two beers. But I ended up having six, seven, eight. You know, when I drank those beers, I was a little bit anxious getting in there. I don't think that day I'd been planning on drinking. And yet when I had those beers, it's like, oh, the weight of the world was off. I was able to talk to those guys. And we drove around. I don't even remember what we did, but no big problems came out of that. So one of the things that made me alcoholic happened right then. I drank more than I thought I was going to drink. And then on top of that, this was something I've enjoyed, man. It provided a relief I'd never known. And the other thing that makes me alcoholic is that idea that I want to drink again. It hit me too, because it wasn't long before I was drinking on weekends, every weekend. And I don't think I was necessarily born an alcoholic, but I can tell you that the day I started drinking, an alcoholic was born. Because, man, I enjoyed it. I loved the way it made me feel. And, you know, that was right after Woodstock. It was the early 70s. Lots of stuff was going on. And I can remember I was driving around with a friend of mine, Drew Doyle. This was probably 6 months later. And we were across the Chattahoochee River. I can remember like it was yesterday. It was May. It was the time of year in Atlanta where a lot of people were going down the river, and they used to have this big thing called the Great Raft Race. And a big radio station, WQXI, would promote it. Budweiser Beer promoted. About 300,000 people went down the Chattahoochee River all on one day. And it was a big drunk fest. People had a great time. They'd get off the side of the river at River Bend, and wild stuff went on there. And they finally had to quit that because the city officials said, this is just too many people having too much fun. At our expense, we have to clean it up. But I can remember that day I was driving along with Drew, and we're drinking beer, we're going across the river, and Drew says, Robert, do you want to smoke some weed? I didn't particularly say yes or no. He said, reach in the glove compartment. So I open it up, and he has this bag of weed. And so I pull it out, open it up, and it wasn't these Ziploc like we have now. It's that old-fashioned sandwich bag that you lick. 8 or 10 people have been licking on it already. And it's got that old 70s pot that's really green, lots of seeds and stems, and when you smoke it, it pops and cracks and burns your shirt and all that kind of stuff. And there was some reefers rolled up in there, and I remember we passed it back and forth, and I don't know, particularly remember getting high, but I can tell you it did impact and improve the effect of alcohol. And I don't know that I love smoking marijuana, but I did enjoy it enough when I was drinking that I kept doing that. You know, when you do that kind of stuff, you end up hanging around other people. And I was dating this woman, and her name was Cheryl. And I can remember we were over at Cheryl's house, and her parents were in the front of her house, and her bedroom was in the back. And she invited me back to her bedroom. And I thought, whoa, what's going to happen here? So we go in the room. She shuts the door and locks it. And she went through this ritual that I'd seen before. She pulls out a mirror, she dumps the white powder on it, she chops it all up, spreads it out, and pulls out this straw, and she bats her brown eyes at me and says, Robert, if you snort this with me, I'll let you feel my boobs. Well, you can imagine what happened. I ended up doing drugs for another 25 years. Now, here is... In Alcoholics Anonymous, where people always apologize for their drug use, and I don't know that apologies are needed when I'm talking to other alcoholics about a little intermittent drug use between my drinking, my drunken binges, and things like that. However, I am alcoholic. I clearly identify as an alcoholic. When I drink, I can't control how much I drink, but, you know, all this other stuff sort of enters in the picture, and it enters into some of the stuff that happens later in life, but my drinking went along, and I can tell you, I started getting into trouble relatively quickly. And I'm just going to tell a couple stories about getting arrested because it sort of leads me into AA, ultimately. So I was 17. I was with a friend, David. We were playing baseball in Athens, and we had this group we were supposed to meet with down in Jekyll Island. So the baseball game was over on a Friday. I'm in our family vehicle, and we take off driving down 75, and I'm drinking and driving, and drinking age was 18, so it was easy for us to get beer. And David wants to take over driving. I think he thought I wasn't a good drunk driver, and he wanted to take over driving, so I let him drive. I thought, this is great. I can just drink, enjoy myself. But we get down to Camden County, which, by the way, is on the other side of Jekyll Island on the way to Jacksonville. He had missed the turn. He got pulled over, and they threw him in jail for driving under the influence, and they threw me in jail for public drunkenness. And we just had to call somebody to bail us out. David said, my parents are out of town. So it's left up to me. I had to call my dad, and my dad was expecting a phone call that I was at Jekyll Island with my friends. We're down there safe, and he gets a call from Camden County Jail that I've been arrested, and we need bond money. That's not what he was expecting, and he was upset, rightfully so. This wasn't the only time he got this call, but this is the first time he got this call, and he says, I'm going to send the money. You and David be at our house, 5 o'clock Sunday. The thing's over at noon. Get on back here. So we get bailed out. We head on down there. We have to make up a story to tell our high school friends why we end up late. And I have no idea what we told them. It's one of those good alcoholic stories, so I'm sure. And so the conference gets over. We head back to Atlanta. We pull into my house. And when we pull in, my dad, my mom are there, and David's parents are there. And they're sitting on the front porch waiting for us. And they sort of read us the riot act. They talked to us about drinking. They talked about drinking and driving, the problems you can have with that, and the problems we could have caused. We could have killed people. And, you know, David promised his parents that he wouldn't drink and drive, and I promised my parents I wouldn't drink and drive. And I tell you this story because David stopped. He kept that promise. I still see him these days, and he doesn't drink. He's the kind of guy that the big book describes as a heavy drinker. Given a sufficient reason, he can stop or moderate his drinking. I made that same promise. I had the same problems. If you matched him and me up drinking, we looked the exact same. I was drinking within a few days, you know. I made promises all the time. See, I'm the kind of guy, it's a real alcoholic, the kind our book talks about, the kind that really cannot stop, just cannot stop. But I didn't know that at that time. I was, you know, in my late teen years. Well, I get out of high school, I go into college, and I go to this four-year college in North Carolina, and you know, I got through that four-year college. It only took me 60 months, but I was able to get through. And the reason I was able to get through is I can take tests. I'm good at taking tests. You give me a multiple-choice test, and I can sort of do 50-50, sort of like on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and I can come up with the right answer. You give me a written test, and I can come up with some stuff that usually pass muster. You give me an oral test, though, and I've got three or four people talking up here, and I've got the other person outnumbered, you know? So I could pass those tests, and I got out of college. But when I got out of college, I found there was one test I could not pass. That was a field sobriety test. And I ran afoul of the law. This was the early 80s. Three times within about a four-month period, three DUIs. I was in real trouble, but I was making pretty good money. So I hired an attorney. And the attorney says, Robert, let me go do all the talking. We're actually going to meet in the judge's chambers. And I thought, that's what I'm paying you for, is to do all the talking. So we go into the judge's chambers. The judge is looking at these three tickets, these yellow tickets. He also had this tractor feed, this old-fashioned printout they used to have, and there was some other arrests on there. They were all related to alcohol, too. And he looks at me, and he says, Mr. Bell, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I was thinking, it's really all those Quaaludes I was eating is the real problem, you know? But I didn't say that. I knew that wouldn't go off well. But I thought of it. But, you know, the judge could have followed that up with further questions. And he had objective evidence. They had clear problems with alcohol. You know, when you get arrested, that's society telling you've got a problem, you can't follow the law. And he knew that, and it's a valid question. A follow-up question would have been, maybe you should try AA, maybe you should get some help, maybe you should go to treatment. But you know, I'd paid this attorney, the fix was in. I don't know what deal he and the judge had, but you know, there was really no real consequences, maybe a few financial consequences. And so I dodged that bullet. You know, I was in my mid to late 20s, and I was having problems. I was doing Quaaludes and cocaine and drinking, just all that kind of stuff, enjoying the nightlife. I had an office down in Buckhead, and so I was living it up. And I remember I had a bad Saturday night. It was one of those Saturday nights that went after a Friday night, and it was just going on and on. And I got up Sunday, and I was an absolute mess. I really hadn't slept the whole weekend. I got up and said, I got to do something about this. And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, when I was young, I went to church. Maybe I'll try going to church. I need some kind of direction. And so I went to church, and I don't know that it helped me, but I was able to kick that cocaine and Quaalude habit. And the way you kick a cocaine and Quaalude habit is you go out and buy a fifth of Old Granddad every day. And you can kick that habit real easily by just Old Granddad about a fifth a day and drinking socially acceptable, no big deal. And so I was drinking at home, sort of tapering off the other stuff, and I really just turned to drinking for a while. But while I was at church, I met this woman, Teresa, and I fell in love. And I tell you, when a woman like that meets a man like me, it's the end of all her troubles. It's the front end of all her troubles, as she was about to find out. And so this is the kind of thing that would happen. It'd be this time of year, and I'd say, you know, it's 5 o'clock. I'll be home in a little bit, but I'm going to stop and have a couple beers with Jerry because the tournaments are on, SEC games are on. There's a good game on from 5 to 7. I'll be home right after that game and have a couple of beers. And I didn't know this thing that y'all were going to teach me about when I got to AA called the phenomenon of craving. So I'm thinking I'm going to have a couple beers, get home at 7, be there for dinner. But yet, I see Jerry, I have a couple beers. Next thing you know, I see other people I know. I'm having a couple drinks. And next thing you know, I meet new people. And before I know it, I've stayed for the next game. And my wife is there home waiting for me. Dinner has gotten cold. It's gotten put up. You know, when I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what I say? The only person I'm hurting is myself. Total disregard for anyone else in my life. The big book tells me selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of my trouble. But I can't see that. I'm just showing up late for dinner. But you know, if you ask my former wife, there's a lot of meaning there, former wife, you ask my parents, you ask my brother, you ask employers, you ask employees, I'm leaving a wave of problems that's going to have to be dealt with by the time I get to Alcoholics Anonymous. So she's putting up with that, but she didn't mind a little drinking, but this is the kind of thing she didn't like. And you know, during this time too, some of her friends were having children. We wanted to have children, and so we were trying to have children, and she was having a hard time getting pregnant, and so they sent her to the doctor and tested her out, and they sent me to the doctor too, and while I was there, they found out about this other abdominal thing that I need to get repaired, and the repair involved a surgery. But I thought, I want to be healthy, I want to be a good father, I want to be a good husband, so I need to take care of myself. And so she was getting that stuff done. I had to have this abdominal surgery, and they scheduled for 3 months out, and I didn't really think too much about it until 2 weeks beforehand, and they called me in for some pre-operation tests and things like that, and I started thinking about this. I said, how big an incision is this going to be? And he said, oh, it's going to be big. You're going to be in the hospital a couple days. I said, wow, that sounds painful. He says, oh, it will be painful. I said, what are we going to do about that? He says, well, when you get out, we have a solution for that. I said, what is that? He says, it's narcotic medication. I thought, that sounds okay to me. And so I have that operation, and when I get out of the hospital, they give me that narcotic medication, and I was looking at the bottle, and it says, take 2 every 4 hours. But I found if you take 4 every 2 hours or even more, you get the sense of ease and comfort that I sort of got from drinking. And so I came up with a plan. And if you're new and you have a plan, you need to tell us your plan. Because your plan is probably a doozy. I should have asked this. How many people here are like, say, in their first 6 months? A few people. Great. Well, it's good to have you all here. So if you got a plan, give us your plan. Tell somebody beside your plan. Tell me your plan. I'd love to hear your plan. But my plan, here it was. I travel for a living, so when I'm on the road, I can drink the way I want to because there's not any oversight from my wife or anything like that. When I'm in town, I'll just pop these pills. Drink on the road, pop the pills in town. This is a pretty good plan. Now, there are some faults in the plan. Like if you take too many, if you're lying unconscious, it does not matter whether you smell of vodka or not. They know something's up. So that's one part of the plan that didn't work. But on this bottle, it did say, do not take with alcohol. And I thought, alcohol might improve the effects. And so I would, when I was in town, I might wash down these pills with a couple of beers. And I'd come home and I had to have drank those beers and it would seem that I got thirsty for beer in particular. And so I'd be home and I'd just be craving another beer and I'd have to look through the pantry or look through the fridge and maybe we're getting low on milk and I'd have to run out of the store, which really meant I'm going out drinking. And so this plan didn't really work all that well, but it did allay some of the problems that I was having at home. And, you know, during this time, we ended up finding that my wife's really going to have a problem having children, and so we started applying for adoption, looking into that. And meanwhile, I'd found that this doctor wasn't quite giving me enough pills to take care of the amount of time I was in town. So I told my family physician about the incision I had and the pain that it caused. And he cared about my well-being, and so he prescribed me some. And it still wasn't quite enough, so I did contact a few other doctors, and they were likewise willing to be helpful to me, the new patient. And so before I knew it, I had a few doctors give me these pills, but doctors also have this idea that they do not want people to get in trouble with pills, to get addicted to pills, and so they started cutting me off. And I thought, this is rather abrupt, but I am a keen observer of society. And I had noted some of these doctors keep their prescription pad in the room where they let me sit by myself. And I thought they might come in handy. And they did. I took them, and I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a pharmacist, but I do write prescriptions. And so I started writing those prescriptions, and I was popping those pills, and I was writing those prescriptions, and I was popping those pills. And when you pop the number of pills I take, you got to write a lot of prescriptions. And if you break the law enough, sooner or later, whether it's running a stop sign, speeding, or writing prescriptions, you get caught. And that's what happened to me. And so I got caught, and I could have dodged the bullet on a first offender status, but had no defense against the first drink, the first pill, the first smoke, nothing. And so I got arrested again. And before it's all over with, I'd hired this attorney in Cobb County. That's where all the arrests occurred. And I was charged with forgery, assault, robbing a drugstore. I really thought they were piling on a bit heavy, to tell you the truth. But they had the goods on me. And this was not like going in with a gun and robbing a drugstore. This was sort of trying to steal stuff out of the drugstore without getting caught. And, you know, I'm sort of like one of those penty ante thieves that can't get away with stuff. I may get away with it for a while, but anyway, I got caught. And so I get this attorney, and he is a high-priced attorney, and I know that because of the amount of money I spent on him. But he's the kind of guy that dealt with murders and all this kind of stuff. He is in on the county. He knew the county prosecutors at Cobb County. It's right there on the square. And he called me in. He says, "Robert, we got real trouble here. You know, we're facing some serious things. There's two things I need for you to do. One is I need for you to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." This is when I got sent to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1992. And so I really didn't know what to think about it, but I can remember I went on a Sunday. It was in January. It was in the church like this, with linoleum floor like that, and folding metal chairs. They're around these round tables. It was a Sunday night at 7 p.m., and it happened to be Super Bowl Sunday. And I can tell you, I was not happy, joyous, and free. I did not feel that way. And, you know, the third tradition says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. It would have been great if I had a desire to stop drinking. See, I had a desire to stay out of trouble. And so they sent me to AA, and I was there prematurely, but I was following the directions of my attorney at that point. The attorney told me something else. He says, "Robert, you've got real trouble here. Right now, there's five different felonies. If they apply 5 years to all this, it's up to 25 years. I'm going to be able to plea bargain it down to maybe a couple, maybe 10 years with 2 years to serve. But I hate to tell you this, but you're going to prison." And I said, "Prison? I'm a jail guy. I'm not a prison guy, you know." And, you know, you give me a week or two, maybe even 30 days, and I can mark that off. But over a year, it was just beyond my scope of comprehension. But I did what the attorney said. I started going to AA, and I was documenting all that. And I'd love to say that I stayed sober for that time, but I was trying to stay out of jail. I was really not trying to get sober. And, you know, my trial date came, and there was overcrowding in the prisons, and they started looking at what had happened. There wasn't any real violence and no guns. And I was able to dodge the bullet of going to prison. I got 10 years probation, 2 years of intensive probation, and that was tough. But, you know, that's a heck of a lot better than going into prison. So I was able to dodge that bullet. Meanwhile, we had adopted a son, Stuart. This was 1987. It was April 28th, and we got a phone call saying a little baby boy's been born. It's down here in Thomasville, Georgia. That's the adoption agency we're working with. And Teresa and I said, they said, "Do you want to come get him? Are you willing to become a parent now?" And we'd gone through the various things that we needed to go through. And so we said, "Yes, you bet." And I can remember as we were driving down there, that was one of those times where I was going to sort of put my foot down. And I was going to put a stake in the ground and say, "Here's where I'm going to stop drinking, stop doing all these other things. I was really committed to it. I need to change." There had been times before, but this was a big one. As a new parent, I had responsibilities for a little bitty baby. So we drive down there, get the baby, bring the baby back, and on the drive back, the baby's crying a little bit. We're going back to my parents are there, her parents are there, and these are people I love. Love all those people. But there's a lot going on. The baby's crying. Diapers are being changed. I'm getting a little anxious about all this and a little bit restless. And before I know it, that firm commitment just slides out of my mind. Maybe I'm making too much of this. A couple of beers, it'll just take that edge off. You know, though I'd made that firm commitment, I could not stay sober. I had no knowledge about how to get sober, how to stay sober. Saying, this is, you know, while I'm still on probation. So I am willing to drink in the face of 10 years where if I violate, they had told me, we're giving you a real deal to not go to jail. If you violate, you're going. And I'm willing to drink. I'm willing to drink. That's the power of alcohol. That is what alcoholism will do to a guy like me. If you're a real alcoholic, an alcoholic of the hopeless type, you drink no matter what. And that's what happened to me. And I kept drinking. So to get on up to that sobriety date, my son was growing up. I was doing what I was doing, working, drinking, trying to stay out of trouble with the law, going to see my probation officer. And there came this time, it was April, it's approaching April 10th, which is my sobriety day, it's the beginning of April, it's spring break. So my wife and I and Stuart went down to visit some friends in Tampa. We go down there, and while we're down there, she gets a call and needs to be back at work on a Thursday. So we come back on a Wednesday. And on Wednesday night, I used to meet some guys on the Buckhead Saloon, so we get back in time for me to go catch up with those guys. I end up drinking some, and though I got drunk, I decided I'll go to work the next day. My wife's going. She's saving vacation days. I'll save vacation days. If you're an alcoholic, you can go to work with a hangover. No big deal. And so I go in, but I'm not feeling good, but I knew the kind of things that I did for a hangover. One of the things I do for a hangover is I take a handful of pills. So I went into work, wasn't feeling too good. It's about 7:30 in the morning. I have a cup of coffee, rummage around my desk, and find some stuff there, because you can't keep all that stuff at home, because if you've been arrested for that stuff, your wife looks for that stuff. So I kept it at work. And so I take a handful of these, and I'm walking around work, and before I know it, I'm getting this feeling. I've had this feeling before, and I know what's coming. And I'm just getting woozy, and all of a sudden, I sort of feel like the shake's coming on, and boom, I fall down, and I'm out. You know, in the background, I can hear people saying, call 911, call 911. And man, it was a mess. Next thing I know, I sort of feel like I'm being hauled off in an ambulance, and I end up at Piedmont Hospital. And, you know, a couple things to note. When you get hauled off in an ambulance to the hospital, you don't have your vehicle there, and they make you call someone to come get you. So I call up Teresa, and I say, Teresa, I'm in the hospital. She says, what happened? I told her. I said, I took a handful of pills, and, you know, it was too much. And here's what she asked me. And this is a great question she asked me, because when you get asked this, you're really ready to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. She says, Robert, is there any hope? Is there any hope? Well, I didn't know if I had any hope. I'm the guy that's the glasses always half full. I have no idea what I told her, but that's the kind of question she asked me. So I'm there at the hospital, and I told the nurses as soon as I came to what was going on, that you know, I'd taken a handful of. So the doctor's in there, and he's going through the discharge papers, and he's saying, you know, you drink plenty of water, you need to rest. And he looks at me, and he says, you know, Mr. Bell, you told the nurse that you took a handful of pills. You didn't even count them. Weren't you afraid of overdosing? And I said, no, doc, I'm afraid of that dreaded underdose. That's what I'm afraid of. And, you know, if you don't take enough, you just don't quite get there. Whether it's pills or booze or whatever the case may be, you know, you got to have enough. It's back in the days of drinking where it's important to buy a lot on Friday and Saturday to get you through Sunday. You know, you have to think ahead. It takes good planning. And so anyway, I get out, and my wife comes and picks me up, and she takes me home. When I get home, there's a bag packed. My wife was a thoughtful person. She says, Robert, you've been trying to get sober at Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's not working. It's not fair to me. It's not fair to your son. It's not fair to your father. My dad had been living with me for a few years by then. My mom had died, and he was from that great generation that could do a lot of things wonderfully, but he couldn't keep house and take care of himself. So we got him to move in with us. And she said, it's not fair to any of us. So she packed me off and sent me off to this treatment center. And I hadn't detoxed yet. The treatment center sent me to where I ended up to get detoxed another time. I've been detoxed more than once, but I ended up going to Peachford. And how many people in here, by the way, have been to the Mental Institute? Raise your hand. A lot of people. How many people have been to jail? Raise your hand. It's a lot of the same people, you know? And if you did raise your hand, talk to the ones that did, because if you don't work the steps, you may get a chance to go there. That's what my experience has been. So anyway, I get to Peachford, and they do all this medical stuff, but while I'm there, I'm sort of getting some impact by Alcoholics Anonymous. They brought meetings in, and I remember these three guys came in. They were bringing a meeting. They had a table. It was a panel thing, and I was there. It was actually in the back lockup. They wouldn't let us go to the open meeting, so they kept an eye on us, and I was there with like three or four of my cohorts, and so they were reading off the title page of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. They were talking about thousands. It's broad-based. Men and women, it's inclusive. Recovered to regain your spiritual, mental, and physical health from alcoholism. They talked about the disease. And so we're sitting back there, and we're sort of snickering to ourselves, making fun of these guys, bringing in the meetings. And, of course, they get to leave from the locked doors. We remain locked in, and we're making fun of them. But, see, Alcoholics Anonymous was making an impact on me. I don't think I thought about that again until a year later, you know. But I remember that. They came in and did that. And while I was at the Mental Institute, too, I can remember there was counselors there, and they'd ask you lots of questions. I don't know if they're social workers or what. But this one guy took me back to his office, and he says, Robert, have you ever been to Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, yeah, everybody in the Mental Institute goes to Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course I've been. Been going for years. And he said, well, did you ever take the steps? And I thought about it. And, you know, I think this is true for everyone in this room. I think everyone in their heart of hearts knows that they've taken the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew I had not. I said, no. And he said, did you get a sponsor? I said, well, in name only. He said, well, did you read the big book? I said, well, yeah, I have a big book. I read it. And he asked me a question, which really proved I had not studied the big book. He said, what did Bill finally do once he got sober? I had no idea. He says, he went back to the place where he got sober and reached out to other alcoholics and told them about his potential plan for rehabilitation, and that they wanted to get sober, they would have to do likewise. And this went right over my head. He said, I've got a question for you. Do you think Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you? Well, I'm an untreated alcoholic. I have an answer for everything. And he says, no. I just want you to think about that. And he sent me back to the day room. So I went back to the day room, started talking to my friends, forgot about all that stuff. But it's a great question. Do you think Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you? So I'm in there going through that. And when I detox, they finally let me out after 17 days. And they said, you're well. And how they knew I was well is my insurance had run out. And so I went right on to the next place. I went to this place called Penfield out in East Georgia, and I spent 6 weeks there, and then I ended up in a halfway house here in Atlanta called Mar. And at Mar is where the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened. I can remember on day one, I met this guy, Matt E. And Matt E., I mean, I had 6 weeks of undisputed sobriety, and he had the nerve to search my car. I could not believe it. But he was teaching me something about AA right then. He's teaching me about resentments. Because I got a resentment at him. I said, what are you doing searching my car? He says, we have to search everyone's car. But that day he also told me, he says, you know, a lot of guys in your house, they go to a meeting on Monday and Friday night. It's Peachtree Corners. And I went to Peachtree Corners. And Meredith was there. There was a lot of other people there that were sober. And that's where I ended up meeting my sponsor. I knew I had to get a sponsor. And so that Monday night, I was eyeing people out. There's this one guy leading the big book study, Pat M. And when he walked around, he carried these two books with him. He carried these two books everywhere he went. And so I knew they'd be back there on Friday, or I was hoping he'd be back there on Friday. So on Friday, I asked if he'd be my sponsor. And, you know, he went through a variety of questions. He asked one key question, though. He said, Robert, can you stop on your own? I said, no, I guess not. He says, that's good. That means you need help. And he says, this other question, are you willing to do whatever it takes to gain victory over alcoholism? And I said, yeah, I mean, you know, start the people pleasing right now, make sure he's happy, you know, I want to make sure he'll sponsor me. And I didn't know what that would entail, but he said, well, let's do this. Let's plan on meeting on Mondays and Fridays. I said, great, well, I'll see you at 8 o'clock on Monday. He says, no, we're going to meet at 7. I said, the meeting's at 8. He says, yeah, but we got to get here and set up the chairs. There's literature to put up. We have to make coffee. And then we're going to study the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, study? He says, yes, that's what we're going to do. I said, okay. So anyway, I started meeting him, and we would get there early, and what I realized, there was other sober people there that got there early, and they were doing things like we were doing. So I met the sober members of Peachtree Corners and the people that wanted to get sober. And so the kind of things we'd do is we'd get the chairs set up and all this, and then we'd sit down and read through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We started on the blank page. We went through the doctor's opinion. We got to that point where it really talked about the physical factor. And in it, it says, any picture of the alcoholic that leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. And, you know, I never really understood the physical factor, that once I started, I couldn't control the amount that I drank, that I drink till I get drunk, then keep on drinking. And these were things that I sort of knew intuitively, but I had never heard people describe it that way. You know, a little later in the book, it says, this is the first step of recovery. You have to concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. And I didn't know how to concede to my innermost self as alcoholic, but as Pat explained it to me, he says, we're having to move it from up here into here. And see, I sort of knew I was an alcoholic, but I never bought into this whole thing. So I sort of get into that step one as I was working through the book. And we also got to that point where it says, do you now believe, or are you willing to believe in a power greater than yourself? And I was willing to believe. Pat had me praying from really the first day I was being sponsored by him, praying on my knees, asking God to help me stay sober, relieving the obsession to drink, thanking the God at the end of the night that I'd stayed sober. And, you know, by this time, I was 4 or 5 weeks sober since I'd been there working with Pat, and this was a big change for me. I'd never had this kind of thing happen, so I was willing to say yes, and he says, well, you're on your way, just like the book says. So we moved on. We got to the third step prayer. Did that immediately. I started taking inventory. He showed me the directions of the big book. He gave me some outlines, said, get a piece of paper, and drew some lines, said, here's what I want you to do. About 3 weeks, I'd finished that inventory process. I met him. We did a fifth step. Took an hour. Before I knew it, I'd done 6, 7, and 8. He had a list of people. He made the list. He said, we make it when we took inventory. Showed me right where it came from. And he helped me figure out which ones to go see and gave me some directions. Before I knew it, I'd taken the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when we got to page 88, I'll never forget. Pat says, Robert, and that's at the end of step 11, if you hadn't gotten there in the book. He says, Robert, you've done everything Alcoholics Anonymous has asked you to do. And step 12 says, haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, talking about 1 through 11. It's now time for you to try and help other alcoholics. And I said, but Pat, I'm only 4 months sober. I've been at some meetings where they say you need to be a year sober. And he says, you know, if Bill had waited until he is a year sober, he'd never gotten to Dr. Bob. And if that had happened, none of us would even be here. It's time for you to reach out and try and help somebody. And it's sort of like a miracle. Before I knew it, I was sponsoring people, and I was thinking, boy, this is sort of crazy, but this first guy that I worked with, this guy, Captain John, this guy was a pilot, and he's still sober today, and all that proves is the message of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is what helped people get sober. It's really not the messenger. And so while I was doing this, I was my dad was older. He is 82, and he is in the hospital. He had to go in the hospital. He had an infection in his pacemaker, and he wasn't doing well. And so I can remember, I visited him on a Saturday morning. It's probably 6 months sober at this point. And he told me this. It's about 6 in the morning. He said, Robert, there comes a time in a man's life when he has to make peace with God and his fellow man. Make peace with God and his fellow man. He sort of did that with his hands. He says, I've done that, and I'm ready to meet my maker. That's what he'd been trying to teach me since I was a little kid. And see, I have to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and drink myself into such a state. I get beaten in that state of submission, where I realized I got to make peace with God and my fellow man. And so that was on a Saturday. The next Tuesday, I was there with my wife, my brother, his wife. We stood around the bed as he breathed his last, and we read prayers he'd want to hear, and we read scripture they'd want to hear, and we tried to make it a peaceful going away. My son Stuart was there. Stuart was 14 by then. And so that was a Tuesday. We held his funeral on that Friday. And like I mentioned earlier, he had lived with us, and I was able to do part of the funeral, and I was able to do the family eulogy, and I knew some of his business friends and things like that. And after that, my son came up, and he read the 23rd Psalm, often read at funerals. And little did I know that inside of 1 year, we'd be reading the 23rd Psalm at my son's funeral. And Stuart was 15 when he died, and what happened, he completed the suicide act. It was July 24, 2002. I was in my second year of sobriety. And so I got up that morning. I did the things that I had been taught to do, and I still do today. I got up, thought about the 24 hours ahead, got on my knees, asked God to help me stay sober, asked him to relieve the obsession to drink. I did the third step prayer as it's written, and I went about my business. And my wife came in from jogging and says, Robert, can you go downstairs and wake Stuart up? And so I went down those 2 flights of stairs. When I went through that second flight of stairs, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. My son was hanging from a rope. His feet were on the ground, and his knees were bent. And I really thought he was going to stand up and say, just kidding, Dad. But that ain't what happened. I ran over and held him. And there weren't going to be any first aid, no CPR. And I ran upstairs. And sort of some of this is reported back to me. Teresa told me about it. But I screamed, And she jumped out of the shower and said, "What's happened?" And I said, "Stuart's hung himself." I asked her to call 911. I picked up my phone and I called Pat, my sponsor. And he said, "Oh my God, I'll be right over." And I'll never forget, he was over there, EMTs were there, the police were there. It's a crime scene until they decide it's not a crime scene. And I can remember we're standing by the coffee pot making coffee, and I was just visiting with Pat, and I say, "Why do these things happen?" And he answered it the way people in AA answer. They speak from their experience. And he says, "Robert, I don't know. I can't explain this kind of thing." And we sat down at the dining room table, and a neighbor had come over, and Pat says, "Robert, get your big book." And I did. He says, "Open to page 63 and give it to John." John was sitting across the table from me. So I opened it up and passed it over to him. And we did the third step prayer. "God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I might help of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. May I do thy will always." I believe that prayer was honored that day and other prayers as well. You know, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened then. I was standing by the front window and I looked out and I saw Matt E. I mentioned him earlier. He is a member of the home group. He pulled up. Next, Art S. pulls up on his motorcycle. And before I know it, a whole host of people that I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous had showed up. And they came in and they really helped nurture my wife and me. And there was others that we knew in the community as well. And I'm a big book kind of guy. I believe in the program. You'll hear people talk about the program and the fellowship. But I believe the fellowship is immensely important. I never minimize the importance of the fellowship. And we open the meeting here with Alcoholics Anonymous as a fellowship of men and women. I believe the sober fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is a really important thing to be a part of. But, you know, the fellowship there really helped me tremendously. Charles Dickens opens a book. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. And you can imagine why that was the worst of times. The tragedy of the loss of a child, the tragic nature, the stigma attached to suicide. I mean, it is problematic. It's a complicated grief. And I was in the midst of crisis at that point. When I say it's the best of times, when I look back and think about my home group showing up, dealing with a situation like that, that's a memory I'll never forget. I felt the love of God through the people that I saw there like I've never really felt since, you know. So I never minimize that. And while that occurred, you know, people were showing us love. Other things happened. When I look back, I mean, obviously this was a time of sadness, and you can't imagine anything happened. But I look back, and there's some things that happened that, in reflection, is rather humorous. I got a call from a guy sponsoring. This guy named Brad, and he was drinking. My son dies. He's drinking. He calls me up, and I said, "Brad, I don't really know what to do. We've got stuff we're dealing with here. Why don't you go to NAB and pick up a white chip? We'll deal with you later." And Pat was standing right beside me. It's good to have a sponsor. Pat looks at me and says, "Robert, you're the luckiest guy in the world." I'm thinking, my son has just died. I said, "What are you talking about, Pat?" He says, "Well, if anyone should be drinking, it's you. And you've got a sponsor out there drinking for you." It is really good to have a sponsor. You know, they see things totally differently. You know, there's sort of a haze of things that went on, but the funeral was held that Friday for Stuart. And there's a host appeal from Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went and buried Stuart up in Forsyth County. That's where we'd bought some graves and some family plots. And it was Friday night. It was the end of the month. It was birthday night at Peachtree Corners. I went to that meeting. This was the second day after I had found Stuart. And I was back in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a bit on edge. Not a lot of people were talking a whole lot to me, but people were offering their condolences. But I got back. And, you know, within a week or two, I was back meeting with guys on Monday and Friday that I'd meet with before our meeting at Peachtree Corners. I'd meet people at 7 like Pat would meet with me when I was getting sober. We were going through the book, and I think these guys were helping me a lot more than I was helping them. But, you know, we stayed sober, and some of those guys are still sober today, and I stay in touch with them. You know, a variety of things can happen. You know, death by suicide, like I mentioned earlier, is complicated. Didn't know how to deal with it. And I was telling my sponsor, he says, "You need to look into seeing what other people do." And the time that Stuart died, some people brought some stuff by, some resources. And there's these groups. It actually meets right across the street from the library, but a group that's called Survivors of Suicide. And it's meant for people who have dealt with loss by suicide, and it's led by peers. It's not some counselor coming in saying, "You need to do this, you need to do that." Rather, people who have experienced it and seem to have gotten better lead these groups, sort of like we do here. So I started going to these groups, and hung around these groups, and I learned to talk about suicide a little bit, and learned that you have to actually tell the story, because if you tell the story more, you can overcome the shocking nature of what's occurred. And after a couple of years, they said, you know, Robert, you communicate pretty effectively, and you don't try and tell people what to do. You really share from experience. I'm thinking, yeah, I learned that in AA. And they said, we think you might be helpful in leading these groups. We've got some training you can do and some resources that you can offer other people. You can lead these groups. Maybe if somebody has a suicide and they want to visit, you go out with somebody else and do a home visit, sort of like a 12-step call. And so I started doing that, and I've been doing that for the last 12 or 13 years. It's opened some avenues to be of service that I would have never really planned on. I've had opportunities to speak at some conferences on suicidology around suicide aftercare to try and help in a larger format when this kind of thing occurs. So sometimes, as the big book says, some of our worst experiences in life can turn into a way where we can be helpful to others. The book says our only desire is to be helpful, and I truly believe that to be the case. Believe me, I'd much rather Stuart be here. He'd be 29. I run into some of his friends now. They're in AA. I think Stuart would be in AA. He was that kind of guy, a bit impulsive. Other things have happened too. You know, my former wife had to live with an active alcoholic for a number of years, and we were there when we sobered up. I tried to make amends, but there's challenges living with a recovering person, and then you have a son die, and it sort of threw a wrench in the engine, if you will. We ended up getting divorced, and I'm really saddened by that, sorry about that, but I'm really pleased to say she's remarried, is doing well, and we touch base periodically around the birth date of Stuart or other reasons as well, and I'm glad she's doing well. And I, too, have remarried. My wife can't be here. She's at that gals conference up there with all the other women in Tocoa, and good for her, and she sends her regards. But I was really lucky to meet another woman in AA, and so we can enjoy a life of 12-step recovery together, and so I'm really grateful for that. And you know, a variety of things that have happened, too. You know, I've been able to stay employed since I got sober. It's really sort of a miracle because I had problems. I had a variety of jobs before I got sober. And since I got sober, I've stayed employed continuously. And if you're new and wonder how that happens, it's pretty easy. Here's what you do. If you're new and you might want to get out a pencil, now'd be a good time to take notes. You've got to go to work. You've got to stay at work. And you've got to work at work. See? And if you put all three of those together, there's a good chance you'll stay sober and employed. One other thing I want to share before I close. You stay sober long enough, you face other challenges. And there's some people in here that know some of the challenges that I'm really just facing now. So I go to the doctor for my physical. He says, you need to go to the dermatologist. You're fair-skinned, in the sun. I run, and generally I run without a shirt on. And so I go to the dermatologist. The dermatologist does some tests and says, Robert, you've got a number of basal cell carcinoma. And I said, what does that mean? He says, that's cancer. And I said, how bad is it? And she says, it needs to be treated. It's not like melanoma, less than 0.001% die, but this has to be treated. And I looked at various options. I could let some surgeon get a knife and cut all over me, and I didn't think that was a good idea. But they actually decided that they would offer treatment through medication, and so right now I'm on chemotherapy, and so this is sort of new, and I was wondering what's it going to be like. Actually, when she first told me, I say, sure, I'll take it. She says, it's not that easy. They had this big box with a DVD in it and all these brochures. She says, you've got to go home and read this and study it before you do it. Talk to your family. So I read it, and there's a lot of side effects, like your hair could fall out. I'd look like Jonas, and which would not be bad. I started checking it out. But there's these other things like body aches and pains and muscle aches. And as an alcoholic, I know I don't like to feel bad. That would not be good. But I thought, I exercise. Maybe that'll be okay. And there's the whole thing. There's the potential of abdominal stuff, vomiting, diarrhea. But I thought, alcoholic, I've dealt with that, you know. So a couple weeks ago, I get this bottle. It's like the old days, I had a prescription, take one out, check my hair, it's still okay. So, you know, I'm facing a new challenge. I'm having to take chemotherapy for 45 days, see how effective it is. The regimen might be 6 months. But, you know, these are the kind of challenges you can face, and really I think that I'm doing pretty good with it. I think the key to so many things in life is the attitude you have, and because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I bought into what the big book says. I really believe when it said God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And I really believe I experienced my life that way. In the midst of the problems I might have had with the loss of a son, dealing with cancer, felonies, this and that. And, you know, life goes along, and it's interesting. I was telling my story about, really, it's about 8 years ago now, and this guy comes up to me and says, "Robert, have you ever thought about applying for a pardon?" I said, "No." And he says, "Well, here's what you do." And he tells me what to do, so I do it. And it's with the state. It's Department of Pardons and Parole. So I send it in, and about 18 months later, I go out to the mailbox. And I remember the day, because the day before my sobriety date is April 9th, 2009. I go out, and there's a letter from the Department of Pardons and Paroles. So I grab it. I run inside, and I say, "Carrie, you aren't going to believe it. This is either really good news or really bad news." And of all things, I got a pardon for those felonies that I mentioned earlier. And so I was running around showing it to everybody, and I've got a copy of it here because there's one really interesting thing. I went and showed it to my sponsor, and he looks at it, and he says, "You know, Robert, it's got this interesting statement here. It says, whereas having investigated the facts material to the pardon application, which investigation established to the satisfaction of the board that the pardon applicant is a law-abiding citizen and is fully rehabilitated." He said, "They did not talk to me." It's about the time for me to wrap up. You know, a couple things I want to emphasize. In my story, I talked about the fact at Peachford, that counselor asked me, he said, "Do you think Alcoholics Anonymous can work for you?" If you're new, it's a great question to ask. If you've been around for a while, it's a great question to consider. Do you think Alcoholics Anonymous can work for you? And two, you know, we find a sense of purpose here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We get a chance to offer people a life of recovery, to recover from alcoholism, a fatal progressive disease. We're uniquely qualified to share that message. Sometimes we have life experiences where we're also given a sense of purpose, like for me to be able to help people who are dealing with suicide. And what I found out is that once you've lived a life of purpose, it's hard to return to the ordinary life. Once you've experienced a life of purpose, it's hard to return to the ordinary life. I also think that if you are working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're engaged in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think there's anything that happens that causes you to take that first drink. If I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's nothing that can make you take that first drink. And I can tell you, there's nothing that I am more pleased about than being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what that means to me is that I have a home group. I have a sponsor. I try and sponsor guys. I take commitments at my home group. I take commitments at other places. And I try and do the things in my life that I'm supposed to do. When I say I'm going to do something, I try and follow through and do it. And to me, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about, and that's what it means to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to finish with one reading out of the 12 and 12. When I was new, I would go to Peachtree Corners to the beginners meeting, and there was a fellow there, Bob M. And Bob would say, "If you're new, buy a big book and buy 12 and 12, read it and reread it." And I followed that direction. And though I believe you've got to use the big book to take the 12 and 12 has a lot of interesting things in it. There's one thing in step 12 that relates directly to all of our lives. Here's what it says. "Furthermore, how should we come to terms with seeming failure or success? Can we now accept and adjust to either without despair or pride? Can we accept poverty, sickness, loneliness, and bereavement with courage and serenity? Can we steadfastly content ourselves with the humbler, yet sometimes more durable, satisfactions when the brighter, more glittering achievements are denied us? The A answer to these questions about living is yes, all of these things are possible. We know this because we see monotony, pain, and even calamity turned to good use by those who keep on trying to practice AA's 12 steps. And if these are facts of life for the many alcoholics who have recovered in AA, then they can become facts of life for many more." You know, I'm really grateful to be here at the Primary Purpose Group. I'm excited to come and tell my story. Good night, and God bless.